On the stage here tonight, we have several folks here that you'll be meeting in just a moment for our two moderators. One of our moderators tonight is going to be Jake Brownell. Jake Brownell is a reporter and producer at 91.5 KRCC, Southern Colorado's NPR station. In his time there, he's covered a wide variety of topics and helped create and produce several original programs. His work has been recognized with numerous statewide, regional, and national broadcast awards and has been heard on public radio stations across the country. This isn't Jake's first time interviewing Ron Stallworth. Back in 2015, as a producer for 91.5 KRCC, the documentary series Wish We Were Here, Jake helped produce an episode about Stallworth's trailblazing career in the Colorado Springs Police Department and, of course, his infiltration of the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. And Jake notably graduated from Colorado College in 2012 with a degree in philosophy. Also joining us tonight, we have the one and only Dr. Paul Buckley. Dr. Buckley is an assistant vice principal and serves as the inaugural director of the Butler Center, our home to diversity, inclusion, and empowerment here on campus. In addition to invaluable service here at the college, Dr. Buckley has served as the assistant dean of undergraduates at Dartmouth. He's co-founded the award-winning WellsLink Leadership Program at Syracuse University and was instrumental in establishing the Office of Institutional Diversity at Andrews University. He has more accolades than is pertinent to mention just right now, but suffice it to say he's earned every one of them, and watching Dr. Buckley speak, especially if he gets riled up, makes you want to heap a couple more on him. We won't do that here tonight, because we'd hate to bore him. And then, of course, we have the one and only Ron Stallworth, our Black Klansman. In a truth stranger than fiction, Stallworth entered as the first Black detective in the Colorado Springs Police Department and would go on to work as an undercover intelligence officer in the Ku Klux Klan. His career has seen him listening to speeches from Kwame Ture, holding pleasant conversations with Klan Grandmaster David Duke, and I'm sure much more run-of-the-mill things. Stallworth moved on after this to work in many other capacities and settled in the Utah Department of Public Safety for almost 20 years and retired in 2005. He's joined here with his wife, Patsy, whom I don't see, but there, she's right here. In his book, Stallworth writes that he was asked how he would respond to racism in the job. He replied that he would with silence and by doing his duty. It is clear that he did one of those things. He did his duty. And while he may have been silent, infiltrating the Klan has got to be worth something. Please join me in welcoming Ron Stallworth and our moderators to the stage.
Ron, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you. Is this your first time in Colorado Springs since the movie came out?
Yes. In fact, a little side story. When we got to our hotel last night, we started walking around and the Peak Theater had the marquee with the title on there. At the age of 19, I work part-time at the Peak Theater as a ticket taker.
Wow. Nice. Full circle.
Full circle.
Yeah, so how's it feel to be back? How do you feel like the city's changed since you were working here in CSPD?
Yeah, all I have to do is see all that traffic on the interstate and rush hour. That didn't exist back then.
Yeah, and does it feel like a homecoming, you know, to sort of see the response that the film has gotten and that your story has gotten here in the town where it took place?
Yeah, you all have been very welcoming, as the folks did earlier today at Pikes Peak Community College. You've been very welcoming to me and my wife, and we greatly appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And is this your first time on this campus, Colorado College campus, or were you here during those glorious years depicted in the film?
Well, when I was writing parking tickets, I used to drive down here and write tickets to it. So I'm familiar with the campus a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I got to say, thank you for providing a first experience. I never anticipated that I would sit and talk with a proclaimed Klansman, and that he would look anything like me. So I'm, you know, really grateful for that. So you have this best-selling book about your infiltration of one, not the only, but one of the notable white supremacist organizations in the country. And you decided to go fully on Front Street by writing this book. Why?
2013, I'd finished teaching criminal justice at Salt Lake Community College. And I had some time. I sat down and just decided that now's the right time to tell this story, and pulled out a legal pad and a pen and started writing. I wrote the first 30 pages, didn't like it, tore it up, put it away for about a week, and pulled it out again and started writing, and something clicked, and wrote for 9 months, and then finally said, I got it, and I stopped. And gave it to the original manuscript I gave to, well, first of all, my wife seated in the front seat here. We were dating long distance at the time, and she asked to read it, and I sent her the unfinished manuscript, and she read it, offered her input. Hers were literally the first eyes to read my manuscript. So my love of my life, Patsy, sitting here, was the first one to read this, and sent it to the publisher, the original publisher, and in May of 2014, it was published.
Mm-hmm. And did you know that it was gonna, I should say, did you have ambitions that it might become a feature film someday, or was that not really in the equation? Were you just trying to tell your story?
No, when you write a book, you don't write with the intention of it becoming an award-winning anything. You write out of the love of wanting to write and of having a story to tell that you feel needs to be told. I felt my story, let's face it, this is a truth stranger than fiction type scenario. Nobody would ever have believed it. And I just felt the story needed to be told. Mm-hmm. So I told it. I had no ambition for it other than get the story out there and move on. And never did I imagine that 3 weeks ago it would reach number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And it was not even in the realm of possibility in my mind that it would be made into a movie someday. These things just fall into place. And call it divine providence, call it whatever you want. It just fell into place that it became a bestseller eventually, and before that, it was made into a movie. Spike Lee and Jordan Peele thought there was something there that was worthy of being told and bringing to a mass audience, and they took it under their helm, and here we are.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about how that came about. Did you get a call? How did that work?
Well, I've got to back up a little bit here.
Okay.
I was visiting my bride in El Paso, where we live now, where I grew up. And I was leaving El Paso, headed back to Utah, driving through New Mexico. And I come to the Colorado-New Mexico border. There's a mountain range, Raton, New Mexico. There's a mountain range there. And I'm going up the mountain pass, and my cell phone rings. It was a gentleman by the name of Charlie Wachtel. Charlie's Jewish. Charlie says he heard about my story. He had bought a copy of the original book, read it. He said, he asked me if it was the rights were owned by anybody. I said, no. He said, if you don't mind, my writing partner and I would like to take a stab at writing a screenplay up for it. I said, what have you done? He said, nothing. I said, okay. So I'm continuing up the pass. I lose the signal. Charlie calls me back. We continue the conversation. Lose the signal. Long story short, we lost the signal about four times. It wasn't until I cleared the mountain pass that I got a clear signal. Charlie and I were able to talk. And I finally agreed to let him write a screenplay. This young kid, about 28 years old, let him write a screenplay on my story. And I told him, you'll have to sign a contract giving me full ownership of your screenplay. And you can't do anything with it unless I give you the okay. He agreed to that. So that's what we did. His partner, David Rabinowitz, both of them are Jewish. It's important to highlight that, as you'll find out in a second. His partner and he wrote four versions of the screenplay. I rejected some aspect of each one. One of the ones that I rejected had a little love scene with John David Washington as me in bed with Patrice, the Black Student Union girl from Colorado College, had this little love scene written in there, and I read it. I'm not seeing it as a screenplay. I'm seeing it as me, and I'm saying, yeah! So I sent that one back and said, I don't like that. Take it out. He said, well, we've got to have some kind of love scene in there. There's got to be a love interest. I said, I'm a cop in the story. I'm a cop. Give me a dog. I want to have a dog. You know? I've seen movies where cops have dogs and follow them around. Give me a dog. But I don't want to see myself in this scene here. So he said, okay, and he wrote another version that had me with a dog. Now, I read it, and even I, with no knowledge of how this is done, even I said, the dog ain't gonna work. Put the love scene back in there, and they wrote a fifth version. The fifth version I approved. You don't see that love scene in there. It wasn't filmed, but it was in the script. But it took five versions to get it right. And the interesting part, and why I highlighted the fact that these two gentlemen were Jewish, what attracted me to them in the first place was the fact that their angle on my story was to make Chuck, the white Ron Stallworth, in the movie, it's Adam Driver as Flip Zimmerman, their angle on it was to make Chuck Jewish, to add tension to the whole thing of being undercover with the Klan. I like that. The real Chuck is not Jewish. But I like that angle, and they wrote it, and I'm proud to say that these two guys who studied Spike Lee at film school now have their name in a Spike Lee movie as co-screenwriters, and we believe they'll be nominated for an Academy Award. Amazing.
This is probably an obvious question in some ways, but how has your life changed since this movie came out, and how has your relationship to your own story changed since the movie came out?
How has my life changed? I have relatives coming out of the woodwork.
Cousins.
Cousins, exactly. There is a site on Facebook called If You're a Stallworth, Say Hi. I got Stallworths contacting me all the time on Facebook. Hi, cuz. Hey, family. And I'm thinking, who the hell are you? I've got friends that I never knew existed, or I've got very loose acquaintances who suddenly are proclaiming me as a dear, 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 dear friend. It's kind of funny. It's kind of comical, to be honest with you. I've got people asking me for favors that never would have asked me for a favor before. The most common favor I'm being asked is, can you contact Spike Lee and have him come visit us or have him come do something for this function that we're having or something like that? I get that all the time. A lady up in Denver contacted me not long ago, wanted me to get Spike up there to help promote their attempt to ban any building that had Klan members' names attached to it. And when I told her, Spike's not interested in Denver. Spike is a Brooklyn boy. He loves Brooklyn.
True.
And he ain't about to travel to Denver, Colorado to promote your little agenda here. She couldn't understand why that was so. So I have this type of thing happening to me right now. Ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand, my wife and I are two kids from the streets of El Paso, Texas, where we grew up. Now this good fortune has rained down upon us in the form of this book and the movie. And I don't consider myself a celebrity. Spike Lee and John David Washington have both told me, you are a celebrity, your reality is different, you need to think differently, you need to approach life differently, because you are, in fact, a celebrity. I don't feel like it. To me, I'm still that kid in El Paso, Texas. I'm still the 19-year-old guy that got hired by the Colorado Springs Police Department and who used to come up here and write parking tickets to some of you all back in the day. But I've had to learn to deal with this newfound celebrity status. I've become very leery of people in general. I now know why celebrities are like that, because so many people want to curry your favor. So I've become very leery of people. I'm very cautious when I talk to people and when they start implying that they want something from me. I look at life a little bit differently now. And thank God I have my wife to keep me grounded on all this and who watches my back. I may say yes to you, but Patsy Terrazas Stallworth is going to look you in the eye and say, hell no. And she'll say it, she'll say it in Spanish, too.
So speaking of having your back, right? One of the things I was nervous about in doing this is sitting next or near to you. And I just wondered if, I wonder if you've been at all concerned about your safety.
No, I was an undercover cop for over half of my 32-year career. We undercover cops don't get frightened about stuff like that. We do it as a matter of routine. Living with that threat is a natural way of life for us. It's in my DNA, you might say. So no, I don't worry about it. I got a call from David Duke a little more than a month ago.
Really?
I know how he got my number. It's not important, but I know how he got my number. And he called me up and we had an hour conversation while I was up in New York. And it was kind of interesting getting this call because I hadn't talked to David in 40 years. And the last time I talked to him, I placed the call to him. This time he was calling me. He was concerned about how he was going to be portrayed in the movie.
I didn't see that coming.
And he was basing all this on the trailer that had come out. The movie hadn't been released yet. But based on the trailer, he was concerned about how he was going to be portrayed. So we talked for about an hour about a wide range of topics. He said he's not a bigot. He's not a racist. And he said he's not a white supremacist. When I pointed out that... When I pointed out that he endorsed Donald Trump for president, who is a bigot, a racist, and a white supremacist, he said, that's not true. All Trump wants to do is promote white culture, white heritage. When I pointed out there is no such thing as white culture and white heritage, he pointed out his Germanic and Irish roots and said it was the Germanic and Irish people that built America. When I pointed out that that was not true, that America was founded by rich, slave-owning, white landowners who were rapists, raping their slave women, producing children by them, he said, that's never been proven. I said, DNA has proven Thomas Jefferson to be a rapist. His reply to me was, Thomas Jefferson was merely promoting white heritage and white culture. When I pointed out that Trump, has basically closed the southern border where we live in El Paso, Texas, along Juarez, Mexico, and is not allowing people in, but he wants to welcome people from Sweden and Norway, white countries, he said, that's because Trump wants to promote white culture and white heritage. This was the gist of my hour conversation with David Duke. And every time I pinned him on something, he would immediately pivot and move to another topic. He didn't want to discuss it. And that's the danger of when you deal with white supremacists. When you pin them on a topic they don't want to talk about, they will pivot and move to something else that they feel they can take advantage of. You have to be on your toes talking to these people because they're very slick. And David Duke is one of the slickest of all. He is very dangerous. And when I was talking to him, it just brought back memories of the undercover phone calls I had with him, except this one wasn't an undercover phone call. He did say something interesting. He said he liked my book, he read it, he liked it, and that he respected me for telling the truth. So anybody who doubts this, the validity of my story, the Grand Wizard himself has endorsed it. He also said he respected and liked the works of Spike Lee. When I told Spike that, Spike said, that's the kiss of death. I don't need that. So, no, I'm not afraid. Dealing with people like that is par for the course. I dealt with it all the time. I worked undercover here in Colorado Springs and wherever I've traveled. Threats eventually come, and you deal with them when they come, but you don't adjust your life, your lifestyle, because you're worried about somebody that's going to threaten you. Anybody can make a threat. All I know is they better get me the first time because I'll kick their ass.
I like you. Yeah. Thank you.
Why don't we take it back kind of to the beginning in terms of your biography and when you signed on as a cadet in the Colorado Springs Police Department. You were the first black cadet in the program at that time. And you, in the book and in the film, there's a scene where you're being interviewed and they tell you that you're gonna have to be like Jackie Robinson. And I'm curious if you could explain what you took that to mean at the time and also whether at that time you felt a a sense of that this was a mission for you, or was it a job? You know, did you feel like you were breaking a racial barrier and doing something sort of politically important at that time, or was it a job, or both?
It was never a mission for me. I joined the police department for one reason and one reason only. That was to make enough money to put myself through college and become a high school PE coach. That was my motivation. But two things intervened to change the course of my my future. One, after a year of being on the job, I was making twice as much money as a college graduate in the teaching profession. And two, and that's a shame, by the way. That's a shame. Teachers should be among, if not, the highest paid profession in the world. You have the most important job, and that is molding the life of young people, the lives and minds of young people. You deserve to be compensated accordingly. That's just one man's opinion. However, I was making more money than college graduates in the teaching profession, and two, I was having too much fun as a cop. So I decided to stick with it, and I stuck with it for 32 years. Being a cadet was just a means to an end. The Jackie Robinson thing, when I interviewed for the job, I was going to be the only black face on the department at that time, and you see it depicted in the movie. It actually was much more in-depth than what the movie conveys. But they did ask me those questions. Are you a womanizer? Do you drink? Have you ever used drugs? Do you smoke pot? It got really in-depth. And keep in mind, I was 19 years old. And then they asked me the biggest question of all. What will you do if somebody calls you a nigga? Notice I didn't say N-word. With a show of hands, how many of you have ever heard someone called the N-word or have used the N-word yourself? With a show of hands. No, you haven't. What you have heard is somebody called a nigga. You've never heard anyone called, hey, you N-word person. Mm-hmm. Think about it. That word came about, ladies and gentlemen, because of the O.J. Simpson trial. When Mark Furman, the LAPD detective, was caught lying when he said he had never used that word before, and audio tapes revealed that he had. So the media, in reporting this, had to soften it up a little bit, so they came up with the term N-word. I hate that term with a passion. Because no one in my history growing up in America ever called me N-word. I was called nigga on three occasions in school, in the El Paso school system. I got into fights over it, as my mama taught me to do if somebody disrespected me. And I got kicked out of school for it. And when I reported to my mama what happened, she wasn't angry that I got kicked out of school. She only said, did you whip his ass? But that was because I was called nigga, not N-word. You cannot take a word that is so despicable, so disgusting, so disgraceful, so demeaning, and try to soften it up by saying N-word. You simply cannot do it. And every time I hear that word spoken, every time I see it in a printed article, I get pissed. Because the word is what it is. The word has defined us as a people for centuries. And that's what that word was used, was to disgrace and diminish us as a race, as a people. Don't try to soften that word with me. Say what it is. The word is nigga, ladies and gentlemen. I don't care how you spell it. It's nigga. That's what it is, an ugly word. So I was asked in my interview at the age of 19, How will you respond when someone calls you a nigger? Will you fight back? Or will you be like Jackie Robinson and turn the other cheek, walk away? And I told him, I could turn the other cheek, because A, I'm not a nigger by any definition. And I knew that if somebody were to call me that, I could turn the other cheek and walk away. I'll catch them someplace else and deal with them. And so I gave the answer, and I must have given the right answer because they hired me. But that scene is depicted in the movie. It's not, it happened a little more in depth than what you see in the movie, but it did in fact happen. And one thing I want to point out, again, I was 19 years of age. Today you couldn't ask a question like that in job interviews. They did back then. They did back then.
And so, you know, given that you were making history in the Colorado Springs Police Department, did that change the way that you felt about the job at all? Or did you feel a sense of, again, so you say you didn't really feel a sense of mission where that was concerned?
No. No. I knew the history of... The fact that there were no blacks working in the department at the time. I knew that they hadn't had any blacks working for the department in quite some time. I knew that all eyes were going to be on me. It's a pressure situation. If you have seen the movie, you see the scene where they come to the records desk in the records bureau and they ask John David, as me, for a record on a toad. That was actually a term that was popularly used within the Colorado Springs Police Department in 1972. Toad. And being, I'm now in this environment, I'm getting ingrained into the new culture that I'm experiencing. I fell in line with everybody else and I started saying toad too. Hey, what's that toad doing? Here's a record on a toad and everything else. But then one day a light bulb went on in my head. And I noticed that all the toads that they were requesting were blacks. I hadn't noticed it before. When that light bulb went on in my head and I realized who toads were, I stopped responding to requests for records on toads. I made them tell me the person's name, his race, his gender, their gender, and their date of birth. They didn't give me that, they didn't get the record. That was my private form of rebellion because I was on probation. I could not fight back because I could have been fired like that. So I instituted my own private form of rebellion by simply refusing to respond to a records request on a toad. You see that depicted in the movie too. When John David said, no toads here. We do have human beings. If you give me the name, I'll get you the record. So there was a lot going on at that time in the department, culturally, racially, that I had to deal with at the age of 19. And keep in mind, when you see the movie begins with John David in a police uniform, which means the timeline is around 25 years of age. Or 22, I'm sorry. Because he does the undercover deal with Stokely Carmichael. I was 22 when that happened. I did not work in the ID and Records Bureau as a police officer. I did it as a police cadet. And I was 19 when I was doing it. So... that's a lot to ask for a kid. And that's all I was a kid. But I had to grow up real fast.
Could you tell us the story about that first undercover assignment, right? Stokely Carmichael.
Kwame Ture. Stokely Carmichael, one of the leaders of the Black Panther Party. Very powerful speaker. I know he spoke on this campus a couple of times back in the time frame. He was coming to give a speech at Bell's Nightingale. And one of the two black bars that were in town at that time. And I was in uniform. I was a patrolman by this time. I was 22. It was April of 1975. And I was asked to, if I wanted to do an undercover assignment, and because I had expressed my belief or my desire to be an undercover cop, they came to me because they needed a black presence, a black face, to go into Bell's. The white undercover officers didn't feel comfortable doing it. So they came to me. I said yes. So I had to go into Bell's Nightingale, my first undercover assignment, and basically they wanted me to monitor Stokely's speech. Gauge what the audience reaction was. How are they responding to Stokely? What they were concerned about, ladies and gentlemen, was Stokely's very powerful, persuasive rhetoric, igniting the black community to go riot. And that's what the department was concerned about. They were legitimately concerned about that happening. So they wanted me in there to listen, gauge the audience reaction, and determine whether or not we as a department would need to mobilize in response to Stokely and his powerful, persuasive rhetoric. So they outfitted me with a wire body transmitter. They gave me $50 in city funds so that I could... I asked the most important question of all for an undercover cop. Can I buy me a drink? And I was told I could buy one drink. And then they gave me a crash course in drugs. They said, if you can buy some drugs, make a drug buy. And when I say a crash course, I mean like in 20 minutes. This is what marijuana is called on the street. This is what heroin is called. This is what cocaine is called. It costs this much, this much, this much. It comes packaged this way. What do you do if somebody puts a gun in your face? How will you respond to that? All of this is depicted in the movie. All of that actually happened. And let me tell you, it was one of the most exciting moments in my life. Because I was finally being given an opportunity to do what I wanted to do. And that's be an undercover cop. That's what I wanted to be. And now it was at my doorstep. I go into the bar. I did the instinctual thing that any cop in this country will do. I found where the nearest exit was, found a table close to it, and put my back to the wall so I could see everything in the room, as wide a berth as I could. And so I could get the heck out of there if something went down wrong. And Stokely comes out. Corey Hawkins, as Stokely Carmichael in the movie, does one bang-up job. He captured Stokely to a T. Captured him to a T. And that's where I found myself falling into conflict, was listening to Stokely's speech that night, because here I am, a black officer, and I'm hearing this black man who I had seen on TV 4 years or so earlier when American cities were burning during the riots. I had seen Stokely. I had seen him advocating black power, and I'm seeing him in person. For me, ladies and gentlemen, he was a African-American cultural hero for a young kid like me, even though I was a cop, 22-year-old cop. He was somebody that I had admired as a teenager in high school. But now here we were in adversarial roles, and yet I was still caught up in his hype.
And every time he said something, I found myself relating to it. When he talked about the only thing white people respect is the power of a gun, I thought to myself, that makes sense. That makes sense. Because a lot of the people that I work with, all they talk about is guns. And they pride themselves on how well they shoot. Me, I could care less. Just as long as I qualify when I have to pull my gun out and on the range, that's all I cared about was qualifying. I didn't care whether it was 100 score or 80 score, just as long as I met the minimum requirement. Because shooting on a range is different than shooting in real life. So Stokely was saying a lot of things that had some relevant truth to me. And I found myself eventually, as the movie depicts, saying, right on, brother. Or, like the rest of the people in the audience, giving the black affirmation of black power, right on. And then it dawned on me, put your hand down. You are in an adversarial position with this man. Stop rooting for him. And that's when my hand came down, and I just started listening. In my book, I talk about the duality of being a black cop, where we live in two worlds, or we have to straddle two worlds. We are too black for the white community and too blue for the black community. That's how I felt that night. Stokely was saying things that meant something to me, that I could relate to, that I believed in, but I couldn't acknowledge it because I was a police officer. And I had to check myself on the spot. You see that depicted in the movie. And that's the dilemma that blacks in America, in public service, especially police, have to deal with. How do you live in those two worlds? The white community doesn't want to accept you because you're black. Your black brothers don't want to accept you, and sisters don't want to accept you because you are an officer of the law. You're too blue. You've chosen to work for the oppressive white man that keeps us under the heel of subjugation. So how do you deal with that, ladies and gentlemen? I got called nigger many a times by my black brothers and sisters simply because I was a cop. I got called pig, I can't tell you how many times. We had to learn to exist in those worlds, and we had to put all that other nonsense behind us. And that was my reality back then.
So this tension of being a black man and being in law enforcement, that resurfaced throughout your work, your entire career? I mean, I also think it's interesting that, I mean, you were here in Colorado Springs, and then, I mean, you know, you went to Wyoming, and then Utah. You know, those are those are interesting choices, right? that are going to bring back this tension in a particular kind of way, and must have been offered particular difficulties for you.
You're right, they were interesting choices, and those choices came about simply because there were two lieutenants here that would not allow me to do what I wanted to do, and that's be an undercover cop. They were determined for me not to achieve that objective, and I was just as determined to achieve it. So I left here, went to Arizona for 2 years doing intelligence work, and I left there after 2 years and went to Cheyenne, Wyoming, working for the Attorney General, doing undercover narcotics work. And in 1986, I moved to Utah and worked undercover narcotics and street gangs for the remaining 20 years of my career. And that all came about because of two individuals in the Colorado Springs Police Department who were determined for me not to achieve my objective. I beat both them suckers. But to your point, they were interesting choices, and in all of them, these are lily, with the exception of Arizona, these were lily white states, Utah and Wyoming for the most part. I was the only black cop in the entire state of Wyoming. I would go into some towns in Wyoming to make undercover drug buys, and literally the black population would soar by 1,000% just because I was there. I remember one case, this is true. I arrived in this one town, I checked into the hotel, and I started walking down the main street, you know, and this pickup truck comes driving towards me and drives past, and I hear the screeching of tires. And I'm thinking, oh, hell, I'm going to have to kill a white person today. And this guy jumps out of his pickup truck, and he runs up to me. God damn, boy, what you doing in town? We ain't seen many of you people around here before. What you doing here? First of all, he called me boy. Mm-hmm. Mistake number one. Mm-hmm. I kept my cool. We shook hands. He said, we don't see any of you people around here. Why are you here, boy? And I told him, I was here passing through. Saw your quaint little town. Thought I'd stop and check it out for a day. Well, come on down to the club. And he tells me about this bar. Come on down and have some drink with the boys tonight. I said, okay. So I go back to my room, rest for a couple hours, and then I go to the club. If you've all seen that Eddie Murphy movie, 48 Hours, where he walks in the bar and all conversation and music stops, that actually happened to me. I go into this, I walk to this club, I walked in, and God is my witness, the music stopped, the conversation stopped, everybody's head turned, and they're looking at me, the only black face in the place. And in the back, I see this one hand doing like this. It was my cowboy friend from earlier. So I walk back to his table, and there's about five or six of them there, and he introduces me to Billy Bob, Joe Bob, Craig Bob, Ted Bob, Leo Bob,
SpongeBob.
And we order drinks and everything, and he's telling the Bob brothers about how he saw me earlier in the day and everything, and how there ain't many of you people here. You people. Mistake again. So what I did was I asked Billy Bob, know where I can buy some cocaine? Oh, yeah, Joe Bob here sells coke. I bought some coke off of Joe Bob. He's done. We drink a little more. I sure would like to get some marijuana. Well, Billy Bob here sells some. Bought some marijuana off Billy Bob. He's done. So then I asked for some heroin. Well, Craig Bob here got heroin. I made four drug buys from these Bob brothers. 3 weeks later, their asses were in jail. Moral to this story, don't call me boy. And don't use the phrase you people to refer to a black man in an all-white town. Because that black man may have a badge and a gun, and he may be your worst nightmare.
I want to stay with the tension a little bit, right?
Why are you laughing?
Because I get so much joy from a lot of what you're saying. That I dare not say myself at Colorado College. but I want to ask you, so, you know, too blue to be black, too black to be blue, and engaging, you know, your job in fighting crime. But I think it's important to make a distinction between fighting crime, right, and then what is the work of community building and being placed in a position to to spy on that? And I'm curious how much, how deep your engagement with the BSU went, your engagement with, I mean, in the book, I looked at the photograph of the ticket for Stokely Carmichael, right? That was the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Other organizations like that, and you being in a position to engage with them, right? That is difficult and presents some tensions, I think, for some African-American viewers of the movie or readers of the book who are like, was this man operating, literally operating against the community?
Was I a double agent?
Yeah.
No, that has been, first of all, there was no interaction with any black student union here. I was not undercover in anybody except the Ku Klux Klan and the Progressive Labor Party. I had nothing to do with any black organization at that time or any other time. Mm-hmm. Somebody put out a false story that I was engaged in black revolutionary movements, that I was undercover on black revolutionary movements at the time. Never happened. Never happened. Okay? I was investigating the KKK, and in the course of that, I had a simultaneous investigation into the Progressive Labor Party, which are a bunch of communists dedicated towards fighting racism wherever they feel it exists. And they believe in doing violence as their means to an end. Never had any involvement with any black revolutionary groups. I had that one encounter with Stokely Carmichael, and that was it. That was it. For me, as an undercover cop, it all boiled down to how does this entail crime or violation of constitutional norms? I had no problems going undercover with anybody, dealing with anybody, if they were breaking the law, if they were violating constitutional rights of people. I didn't care who you were, black, brown, or otherwise. If it required an undercover assignment to get the matter straight, so be it. If that made me disloyal to my people, screw my people. Simple as that. And that was my approach to dealing with this back at that time when I was being called a pig and a traitor and everything else simply because I chose to wear a badge and a gun and a uniform. I didn't tolerate that. So, no, there was no revolutionary movements that I was undercover on. One encounter with Stokely, and that was it.
Thank you.
And let's turn to the KKK investigation, you know, the incredible story of that investigation. You know, maybe you can just walk us through a little bit how that got underway. And I think one of the big questions that I have, you know, when you see the film and you hear the story is, you know, you make the call, you make contact with the Klan, you give them your real name accidentally. Why at that point stay on the investigation? Why not turn it over at that point to Chuck to just kind of handle the whole thing?
You ask what a lot of reporters have asked me since this movie, since before this movie came out and we've been doing publicity on it, is why didn't you just give it to Chuck? The simple answer, and the only answer, is Chuck was a narcotics investigator. I was an intelligence investigator. This was an intelligence investigation, not a narcotics investigation, okay? I needed a white face, and I chose Chuck because he's a good cop. Good undercover cop, and he was about my height, my weight. And in one of the calls I had with the Klan people, I told them what I looked like, minus skin color, but I basically described Chuck, because he was my height and my weight, and I knew how he came to work dressed. So there was never any hint of turning it over to Chuck because it was my investigation. Chuck was just the face that I needed. He had his own narcotics caseload, and then he had the lieutenant, again, the lieutenant that tried to stifle my attempts to be an undercover cop. He had that lieutenant that didn't want to give me the use of him, and I literally had to go over his head to the chief of police. And when I say go over his head, I bypassed, my sergeant approved, and the two of us went to the chief of police directly, bypassing the lieutenant, the captain, the assistant chief, and our rank structure back then. That was a career-ending move on my part. But I didn't care. I didn't care. I wasn't going to let this lieutenant stand in my way of doing what I felt was right, and that was getting this investigation off the ground. I didn't make a phone call to initiate this investigation. I saw an ad in the Gazette, Ku Klux Klan, for information. Then there was a P.O. box. This afternoon, by the way, the reporter that wrote that story in The Independent, John Weiss, he researched and he actually found the clipping from that ad. I actually have the newspaper clipping with that Ku Klux Klan ad in it. I responded to that ad. I wrote a note to the ad. And in it, in my note, I'm going to say it like they say in the movie. I said, I hate niggas, spicks, chinks, Jews, Japs, and anybody else that isn't pure Aryan white like I am. And I want to do something about this. And then I foolishly had a brain cramp and signed Ron Stallworth instead of my undercover name. As it turns out, it worked for the better in the long run. It added a sense of irony to this whole story. But don't ask me why I did it. It just happened. I did, and I signed it. I gave the undercover phone line, which back then it was an untraceable line. My investigation, ladies and gentlemen, back then, could not be done today because they could easily just Google me and find out all this stuff up front. We didn't have that back then. So I put the untraceable phone number there and mailed this note off, forgot about it. About a week or two later, I get a phone call. The guy identifies himself as Ken O'Dell, says he's a sergeant in the Army at Carson, and he's the local organizer for the Colorado Springs chapter of the Ku Klux Klan under David Duke. Said, he got my note. You have some very interesting ideas. Why do you want to join the Klan? I repeated what I said in the note, but then I spiced it up a little bit. I said, my sister is dating a nigger, and every time he puts his filthy black hands on her pure white body, it makes me cringe. I want to do something to stop the perversion and abuse of the white race. He said, you're just the kind of guy we're looking for. When can we meet? The investigation was off and running at that point.
And did you feel like it, I suppose you mentioned that it took some convincing, basically, to let your, to get your superior officers to let you do this investigation, that you kind of had to move the ball forward on it, go over your commanding officer. Why do you think that was? Why do you feel like it had to be you to sort of make this investigation happen?
It wasn't me that had to make it happen. It's that the lieutenant had a beef with me. We had had some history, and he had a beef with me. I actually worked for him a year earlier, and he kicked me out of narcotics. And when I went to ask for the use of Chuck, it's payback time. So he denied the use of Chuck. And in his denial, he said, this whole idea won't work. He said, the minute Chuck walks into this meeting, they'll know, once they hear Chuck's voice, that he's not the person they talk to on the phone, because they'll recognize his voice and seeing him as that of a white man versus the black man, you, that talked on the phone. I said, what do you mean? What does a black man sound like? I got a blank stare from that lieutenant. He couldn't answer that. I asked him a couple times, what does a black man sound like versus a white man? I'm going to ask you, ladies and gentlemen. Anybody want to take a stab at answering that? And be very careful with what you say. What does a black man sound like that makes him different, that makes his voice different on the phone than that of a white man? Anybody? Speak up freely. Wise decision. Because unless somebody is trying to be a stereotypical Ebonic talking thug, you really can't tell the difference. And I'll even check myself for using that phrase. Okay? I'll check myself for using that phrase. Because not all thugs talk with Ebonics, and not all thugs are black. But that's what they meant back then when he said that my black voice was different than Chuck's white voice. That the minute I opened my mouth, I would give away the fact that I was a black man. In the movie, John David says Ron Stallworth is fluent in both English and jive. And that was true back then. Some of my undercover personas over the years, I posed as a pimp. How do you pose as a pimp? Do you talk different? Do you dress different? How do you convey to somebody that you're a pimp? There are different ways of doing it. And not all pimp look like what you see in some of these movies where they have feathers sticking out of their hats and they have bell bottoms and they got 6-inch platform shoes. Not all pimps look like that. That's a stereotypical image that Hollywood portrays. I knew a pimp here who was white, had a cowboy hat on, was missing 2 or 3 teeth, and the others were rotten, and yet he had 2 girls he was pimping on Colorado Boulevard by the Cotton Club. Back in the day. It's not about whether you're black or white, or whether you sound like some Ebonics talking thug, or whether you're some white thug wanting to be black and using the N-word. It's how you portray yourself, how you convey yourself, and how you can persuade a woman to sell herself and give you all the proceeds. So the lieutenant did not want to help me. So that's when I decided to go to the chief and go over his head. The chief ordered him to help me, to cooperate. And that's how this investigation got off the ground. The chief basically ordered the lieutenant to give me all the resources that I need, starting with Chuck. And that's how this investigation took off.
So you did feel like you had the backing of the department when you started on this investigation. And I suppose, what was it that you were hoping to accomplish with this investigation at the outset?
It was strictly an intelligence investigation. For the uninitiated, you have criminal investigations, you have intelligence investigation. A criminal investigation is just that. You're investigating a crime with the specific intent of bringing somebody to justice and bringing them into the criminal justice system for adjudication. An intelligence investigation, on the other hand, you're seeking information on whatever it is you're looking into. You're strictly gathering information. Hopefully, that information will pan out into a criminal investigation at some point, but it may not. And depending on what the stuff is that you're investigating, you could gather a whole lot of information and file it away for later use. One of my jobs as an intelligence detective was to monitor subversive activity in Colorado Springs. What is subversive activity? Ku Klux Klan is. okay? And that's what I was doing. I was monitoring that, gathering information. I wanted to know the who, what, where, when, and why, and how of these guys calling themselves Klan who had put that ad in the classifieds. Gather as much of information as I could, and let's see where that information takes us. During the course of my investigation, most of these guys were Army, Fort Carson. They were carrying guns back before there was such a thing as concealed firearm permits. So I could have arrested the whole kit and caboodle for illegal firearms possession. But that's a misdemeanor worth probably $300 fine. I didn't want that. I was going for a felony. So we ignored the fact that they had guns. We were aware of it. We were cautious of it. But we ignored it. We didn't stop them. We let it go. And as it turned out, they talked about burning crosses. Never happened. It's one of the things I'm most proud of in that investigation, ladies and gentlemen. If you lived in Colorado Springs in that time, you never had to wake up and see a burning cross picture in the newspaper or on your TV newscast at night, because we stopped two of them directly and one indirectly. How did we stop it? They invited me to participate in the cross burning. I had conversations on the phone with them where they told me they were going to burn a cross. They told me where. And I was invited to participate in this quote-unquote holy ritual. So what I did was I hung up, I contacted my dispatcher, told him that in such and such location, they're going to meet about such and such time. Can you put extra patrol units, uniform patrol units, in the area during that time and just have them cruise up and down the location? Where there may have been one police car cruising normally, on some nights we had three cars or four cars. And it was just a short period of time. And because we didn't have instant communication with cell phones back then, I had to wait 24 hours to find out whether my plan worked or not. So the next day, they would call, or I'd call them, how'd the cross burning go? We didn't do it. What happened? Well, we went over there to set up the cross and everything, and when we got there, there was a police car coming north, one coming south, one going east, one going west. We just decided to call it off. You see that depicted in the movie, too. They did this twice, where I was invited. We pulled that stunt twice. They called it off. Didn't happen. The third time, they were planning a cross burning, and they decided, hey, it didn't work the last two times. Let's just not do it, and they just ignored it and didn't follow through. So nobody in Colorado Springs ever had to wake up to the site of a domestic act of terrorism, which is what a cross burning is. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to wake up to that. If we had let them burn the cross, we could have arrested them for some kind of criminal act, criminal mischief, something. But it never got that far. So that's the difference in a criminal investigation and an intelligence investigation. And my investigation gathered a lot of information. We stopped the cross burnings. We identified the two people at NORAD. They were two top secret personnel at NORAD monitoring North American airspace. We found them out. I got invited to NORAD and met the deputy commander at that time, who was a full bird colonel. He placed a call to the Pentagon, talked to some general, I don't know who, and that general gave him the order to get rid of those guys by the end of business that day. And I was told they were going to be transferred to, quote unquote, the North Pole. And when I asked what he meant by the North Pole, he said, let's just say it's the farthest, most northern military installation in the U.S. command. I said, is it near the North Pole? they wouldn't say. So I don't know where they sent those guys to. All I knew is that they were not at NORAD by 5 o'clock that day. Okay? So that's another thing we accomplished with this investigation. We identified through intelligence the link between the Posse Comitatus and the Colorado Springs chapter of the KKK. Posse Comitatus was another right-wing far extremist group. They later evolved in the 80s and 90s. They evolved into these survivalist groups, these militias. But the Posse Comitatus was meeting with our guys, and the posse tried to convince our military guys to steal automatic weapons and explosives from Fort Carson. We had this information. The FBI got very interested in it, and we were passing the information on to Fort Carson without revealing the fact that we had this undercover investigation going on. That's what intelligence does. We also identified the links between not only the posse and the Klan, but between the far right-wing groups up in the Denver area. I had David Lane, if you've ever heard of a group called The Order. The Order was a far right-wing group that was going around robbing banks in the 80s, robbing banks and killing people to collect money for their cause, which is basically the salvation of the white race. David Lane was one of the drivers in some of those bank robberies. He was meeting with our guys undercover. Okay? And we identified a link between David Lane, our Klan guys, the posse, the American Nazi Party out of Denver, and the Alabama KKK. I was talking to the Anti-Defamation League up in Denver, and they were asking me for information. They would develop something, want to follow up on it, and would call me and say, can you contact David Duke and ask him this for us? So I would call David Duke up, and in the course of my conversation, I would ask David, oh, by the way, I heard something about this group protesting the Defamation League. What do you know about that? And he proceeded to tell me what he knew. I'd hang up and call the Anti-Defamation League people up and say, David says this. So he was snitching on himself. That's what intelligence is, ladies and gentlemen. This was a very successful intelligence investigation. And not one person was arrested. David Duke always is quick to say, well, we weren't arrested, so what's the big deal? No, you weren't arrested. No crime was committed. But you were doing all this other stuff. And I could have arrested you for the illegal firearms, but I didn't. But that's what intelligence is. It was very successful.
So in the book and in the movie, so one of the interesting takeaways that I think at least I have from the movie and the book is that, speaking of intelligence, you just really want to shine a light on how stupid white racists are. I mean, in the book, you call them idiots several times. And that's, you know, I leave the movie kind of laughing about this piece. Is that an accurate reading? Should I have taken that away?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thanks for that.
In the book, I specifically say that these guys I was dealing with were not the brightest light bulbs in the socket, and they weren't. Mm-hmm. They should have known from the very beginning that they were dealing with two different people because Chuck's voice and my voice are totally different.
Mm-hmm. You'd and have, not because of your race.
Not because of race. Race had nothing to do with it. His voice is just different. Mm-hmm. You have to be deaf, dumb, blind, and just plain stupid to not recognize that there were two different people mm-hmm. talking to you. And that's what these guys were. Mm-hmm. They should have known that One time, they almost figured it out. Chuck had gone to a meeting that I had set up at Ken Odell's house. Ken showed Chuck his collection of 13 guns and told Chuck how he carried a gun with him at all time, which was valuable intelligence, because now we know that if we ever stop Ken Odell, we better have our guns drawn on him because he has his and he may come out shooting. So Ken is showing Chuck all of this, his gun collection and everything else, and Chuck leaves. Ken and Chuck talk about a lot of things. Chuck leaves, comes back to the office, and then Chuck goes and starts working on a narcotics case of his. Something was said that I wanted to follow up on, so I waited an hour, and then I called Ken back. Ken answered the phone, and the minute he heard my voice, he said, "What's wrong with your voice?" in this accusatory tone. And I said, "I have a sinus infection." He said, "Oh, I get those all the time. Here's what you need to do." And he prescribed a remedy for me. He recognized that the voice was different on that one occasion. Why didn't he recognize it any other time? Because, ladies and gentlemen, from the very first contact I had with him, he had been reeled in. He believed the story that I laid out about my undercover identity. And if you are able to successfully reel somebody in an undercover investigation, and that initial contact, they will tend to believe you from that point on. And in some cases, you can offer them solid proof that that story is not true, and they won't believe the truth that you're presenting to them, because they are so hooked on what you laid out to them from the beginning. And that's what happened with Ken. He was reeled in from the very beginning, and he wouldn't let his own ears reveal the truth to him that he recognized in that phone call. We had him. We had him. And we had all of them.
As we begin to wrap up, we'd like to get your reflections on protests, because toward the end of the book, you share a story that you don't have to get into here, where you name a particular situation as a faux, quote, faux crisis of racial injustice, right? And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about protest in general as a subversive activity, and specifically the current moment that we're in, what protest looks like right now. What are your thoughts?
I am a career police officer, retired. I love my brothers and sisters in blue, wherever they may be. But one thing that I don't abide, never did, never will, is when there is a bad apple amongst us. Because when that bad apple is revealed, that bad apple needs to be eliminated from the barrel. I don't abide by this so-called blue wall of silence. The reason you have bad cops and why they're allowed to flourish and prevail and expand is because the blue wall of silence gets erected around them. If more cops were to stand up when a bad cop is presented in their midst, if they would stand up immediately and bring this information forward, a lot of problems could be eliminated. But the peer pressure in law enforcement is such that people are afraid to do that. They're concerned about their future careers. They're concerned about having friends on the force. And one great concern that weighs on their mind is they may need this person or another person in the department to back them up in a tight situation, and that person may not be there when they need them the most, which it would be shameful if it did happen. But the fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, there are bad cops. And when we find them, we need to eliminate them from the equation. I have no problems calling out cops who I view as bad. I have lost friendships in this city, in this department, guys that I worked very closely with 40 years ago, because I have called out bad cops and their activities around the country on Facebook. I've had people tell me, no, we should support our brothers in blue no matter what. And I call bullshit on that. Plain and simple. I don't want a dirty cop amongst the ranks of the profession that I consider honorable and that I held dear for 32 years. I don't want that individual in that organization. You all saw the videotape of Walter Scott down in South Carolina, who was shot in the back running from the officer who had stopped him. Walter Scott was about 10 to 13 feet away when the officer pulled his gun and shot him in the back, and it was caught on video. I've had officers defend that act. Not the act, defend the officer. Simply because he was an officer and we should support him until all the evidence is in. I don't need evidence to come in, ladies and gentlemen, to tell me what I just saw on video. So, in terms of protest movements like Black Lives Matter, let's understand one thing about Black Lives Matter. It arose out of the Ferguson riots when Mike Brown got killed 4 years ago, whatever it was. Their purpose was to highlight what they thought was the unconstitutional abuse of authority by the police. It had nothing to do with them targeting cops as has been portrayed on Fox News. Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter advocates working with the police and the community to improve conditions in the community. They do not advocate attacking police officers. That is not part of their agenda. And if anybody would simply read what they're about, you could recognize this, but the people at Fox News can't read. So I support Black Lives Matter in general. I do not support Black Lives Matter or any other group if they are arbitrarily going around accusing police in general of being dirty cops, of being crooked, and of being out of line. You show me the evidence, I will defend. If you show me the evidence of a bad cop, I will be on the side of those who are protesting that cop and that department. I'll stand with you 110%. But until you show me that, I will stand by my brother and sister officer. And when I do find proof that they are bad, they're out of the picture for me. That's how I live my life. That's what I believe. And that's how I continue living my life. I believe in being fair to the situation at hand. And dirty cops need to be eliminated from the equation. You should be honorable in the oath that you took to uphold the Constitution. You should live that oath, live it fully. And if you cannot do so, pull that badge off, put that gun away, take that uniform off, become a garbage collector. And that's not to diminish garbage collector. But get out of the profession. You don't deserve the public trust if you can't handle it, okay? Any other protest movement that's out there, I take each one individually as they come up. I don't arbitrarily join one side or the other. You show me the facts, and then I'll weigh in, and that's the position that I will take. That is my, that's how I exist, plain and simple.
Well, it's 9 o'clock. I think that concludes the remarks. Thank you so much, Ron, for doing this.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And